are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. We are the ones, we've been waiting for. We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting. We are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the ones. So I sing that all the time. It kind of grounds me, reminds me through really tough times of social justice work that I've been doing over the past 15 years that I'm not going to be in collusion with systems of oppression. So that was kind of the first song. And the second one is like, why wait for someone to do it when we're the ones we've been waiting for? And that's basically how I've lived my life since the age of 12, when I upset my K-12 teachers, always asking, why is everything about whiteness? Why is everything about whiteness? Why do you treat the animals this way? So that's kind of been my guiding principles and the music I want to share with you, and hopefully you can think about what that means.
Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. Today is Friday, June 26, 2015. My name's Alyssa. I'm joined in studio with some of my favorite humans. Amir is on the controls today.
Hey.
And we have Darren joining us.
Hello.
And Beck.
Hello, hello.
Thank you so much for coming today. I invited Darren and Beck to join me today because they were with me at the 3rd annual Resistance Ecology Conference, which happened a couple weeks ago down in Portland. That clip we heard was Dr. Breeze A. Harper, one of the curator of the Sista Vegan project and book of the same name, and she presented a talk at Resistance Ecology about the vegan praxis of Black Lives Matter. It was a really powerful talk, one of the keys from that conference. And today we're focusing fully on the Resistance Ecology Conference, and we're going to be hearing a clip from Breeze's talk soon, very soon. Stay tuned for that. Also, I interviewed some of the participants and presenters at the conference, just short little interviews. I wanted to give people a feel of what it was like. So, Darren, can you explain a little bit about what Resistance Ecology is?
Its mission is to really bridge the gap and build coalitions and between the Earth Liberation and Animal Liberation movements. At least that was the main goal when it started. And my own observation tells me that it has kind of transformed as the organizers are also kind of learning about various other different causes, such as anti-colonial struggle and indigenous land defense, and how that's all connected to animal liberation and earth liberation as well. So that's been tying together.
And I think that the conference is so, I mean, I got such a sense of inspiration being there because people aren't just asking for change. People who go there are forcing it. They are actively resisting these systems of violence. And the intensity and how saturated our culture is with imperialism and capitalism and colonialism kind of makes it difficult to imagine ourselves outside of such a society. But what conferences like this do is they bring people together who are resisting and who are imagining better worlds outside of this current one. So just to be around that is really, really amazing because it re-inspires you.
Yeah, definitely. And and it's very challenging. It's very challenging for people. I mean, most of the people who are there are primarily would identify as animal activists or animal advocates. We're trying to speak out about what's happening to non-human beings and fight for liberation and justice for animals. And what this conference brings is like, it really challenges everyone to think deeper and broader and to consider this as a very serious social justice movement, not the only one, not the most important one. And while we're fighting for animals, we need to, you know, remember that we're part of something so much bigger, and because we have such a history of alienating other movements in so many ways.
Yeah, exactly.
For sure.
I will share first a little clip of just some little interviews I got actually in the lunch line on day two. So you can get a little sense of what kind of people were there and the energy at the conference.
I've been really blown away just like the variety of like different talks that are going on. I was really interested in seeing like getting more into like the Know Your Rights trainings and like the, like that was just, you know, I mean, useful for me for reasons. But being able to see like the spoken word and just find out about movements that I wasn't even aware of, because, you know, I'm so focused on like animal rights, animal liberation, like being able to like kind of step outside of that and see how that connects to other movements in the area. It's been, I don't know, it's been really inspiring.
I've been vegan for 11 years for animal justice reasons, and I'm doing a little table here for the Stop the Cormorant Killing campaign. There's a massive cormorant culling happening in the Columbia River, so we're trying to do a pressure campaign to get that stopped. I'm really inspired at the overall theme of uniting workers' rights and social justice with animal rights and animal liberation, because I think those issues go hand in hand, and they always have in my heart, and that you often see those communities kind of butting heads, and so it's exciting and inspiring to me to see this conference really focusing on bringing those things together.
Yeah. I've been really impressed with the way that I've seen this conference kind of transformed each year, especially this year. The really strong Indigenous perspective has been included really powerfully. I think that's what's really cool about it, is it's really vibrant, and activists are connecting. I've heard several times throughout the course of the weekend that people are saying that they've never been to kind of a more radical talk on how we kind of need to shake up the animal rights movement. There's a lot of white supremacy that kind of is still in place in a lot of the animal rights work and a lot of the organizations that are controlling the funding and everything. So that's why I think this something like this is really vital and important.
My name is Ajamu Umi, and I'm an organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party here in Portland, Oregon. One of the common themes I've heard all weekend, which is great, is that we live in a backward, decadent capitalist system that's anti-human, it's anti-non-human animal, it's anti-plant, it's anti-everything. And plug into that, we have to have some level of understanding and cooperation so that we can all fight together to make this a better world.
So that was just some of the participants and presenters at this year's Resistance Ecology Conference. Beck and Darren, did you have like favorite talks? I know you both brought clips today, and I'm excited to share them throughout the hour. Did you have any other kind of like just general impressions of how the weekend went for you?
Beck, would you like to go first?
Yeah, I think what really struck me was this idea that, you know, the people who have constructed the system that we are living in currently, the pervasiveness, the saturated nature of how oppressive our politics are right now, you know, this all started also with just individuals, and it's so great to see individuals feeling empowered enough and believing that they can actually affect change. I think that this energy has not been in our movement for a long time. We need to start believing in our goals again and strategically moving forward to achieve them. And I think that energy hasn't been there. You know, what is animal liberation? What does that really mean? And so for me, the conference really just hit all the right buttons and reconfirmed my intuition about certain things and brought that energy back. So that's really what I got from it. Yeah.
Yeah. And you shared with me an article this week of some really exciting and beautiful news from Germany. Would you mind sharing that?
Right. So surprisingly, in a surprising turn of events, the German military has set aside 76,000 acres of forests, marshes, meadows, and moors for wildlife. And they're meant to act as nature sanctuaries for birds, beetles, and bats. So what a great opportunity for Germany to restructure its landscapes like this.
And that was former military border?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, things can change.
Yeah, it's a really a beautiful metaphor. Yeah. And I think it was Earth First who reported that.
Yes, you're right.
And actually, speaking of Earth First, the resistance ecology folks, they created a zine that is a primer for animal activists, and they said they wanted it to be like the Earth First, like, eco defense manual. They think that, you know, that manual is important. It's about direct action and resistance and how we can individually really fight back and make a difference and fight the state. And last year they produced a zine that was like similar, a theoretical primer of how we need to all, like, you know, broaden struggles and kind of drop this focus on consumerism. And it's really powerful. And if people, you know, want a copy or want to find out more about resistance ecology, it's all on their website. Anyone can look it up. There's so many resources there. And all the videos from the conference have been posted as well. So we're just going to share some highlights first. Let's get into Breeze Harper. First, I'm just going to share a little clip from DJ Kavum. He's a good friend of Dr. Breeze A. Harper, and she talked about him very highly in her talk.
If you don't understand, it's the King Albert plan, and the 1% scared of the free black man and my energy. Look at me, body made of sun, moon, and stars, ride for the cause, full justice, and free Mumia from the bars. Life is so hard, but you know I'm living easy. Came from the hood, son, so you know how we be. Smarter than them pigs, so them cats can't touch me. Rocking clubs in the UK, they said they love me. Africa's next, I sit back and relax. Black human seed, master cleanse with the flax. Word to Bobby Hutton, they ain't occupying nothing. Matter of fact, they ass is fronting. They must be lazy, waiting on the FDA to feed they baby. You want it, I got it, see me in the farmer's market. Roots, beans, and greens, and the melons and things. And with that wheat grass.
Okay, so now we're going into a shortened clip of Breeze Harper's talk. So in this talk, Breeze Harper just talks about the conference she organized in April 2015, entitled The Vegan Praxis of Black Lives Matter. During this talk, she'll explain how critical issues around Black Lives Matter and Ahimsa-based veganism are inseparable.
Last year, when I was online, maybe it was Twitter, maybe it was Facebook, and I encountered yet another post by mainstream self-identified white vegans saying things like vegan praxis and black lives, there's no, what's the connection? And, you know, why are we only looking at Black Lives Matter, only animal lives matter? I got incredibly infuriated because for me, veganism, the way I define it, it's ahimsa. It's rooted in nonviolence and harmlessness, and I'm applying that to all living beings. And then understanding what does that mean when I'm looking at Black Lives Matter and Black liberation through that lens, and what are people who are Black identified, who are vegan, how are we actually handling Black Lives Matter through an anti-racist and anti-species platform? What does that look like? When I was thinking about this last summer, I realized there needs to be a conference put together about the vegan practice of Black Lives Matter, because no one's doing it, and obviously we need to talk about it because there is no disconnect. You cannot have an anti-species world if you have a world embedded in systemic racism. You cannot have an anti-racist world and not think about non-human animals. You just can't do it. And, these were the several main questions that we asked during the conference. What does a vegan praxis of Black Lives Matter look like? What does veganism that ignores Black Lives Matter look like? And what are the unintended consequences? Why do race and whiteness matter? And how do they operate? Over the past decade, I've engaged in critical race and critical whiteness analysis of the North American vegan movement relentlessly. And it was clear to me that, you know, the rhetoric is always, it's most likely, you know, you're going to run across rhetoric that's very post-racial, that race has nothing to do with consumption. Recently, the brilliant and the race-conscious Black-identified vegan chef, Bryant Terry, ruminated over how the cookbook Thug Kitchen, which came out in 2014 fall, was in contradiction to the core themes that can be found in the Black Lives Movement. The controversy surrounding Thug Kitchen became a microcosm of how races lived differently in the USA by white-identified people, such as the authors of the book. The authors refused to acknowledge the dangers of how their own white neoliberal geopolitical status was in collusion with maintaining systemic racism and anti-black violence. They simply could not reflect on how their use of the word thug was not innocent, but relied very much on the racialization of Thug as a scary black urban male gangster. Such denial was a clear indicator by Thug Kitchen protesters, such as Lisbeth Ross, who actually presented as a keynote speaker for the conference. So there's this denial and there's this movement of black and other people of color vegans who are trying to understand why the Thug Kitchen controversy was not as, I guess, well-received and understood that they wanted to be in mainstream vegan America. During the conference, I invited Lisbeth Ross to actually give the keynote talk to talk about the prison industrial complex, which is connected to this, you know, notion of who is a thug and who deserves to be profiled as a thug. And then, you know, I also invited other speakers to talk about what it means to understand, you know, when you have the prison industrial complex, you know, you've got these people who are incarcerated, high rates are black and brown men, and what it means that the corporate capitalist kitchens, such as, you know, corporations that actually go and contract with places like Whole Foods, who have contracts with Colorado Correctional Facilities, they actually have people who are inmates making food. So Whole Foods has a contract with them to get tilapia fish. And they have a contract with the correctional facilities for the inmates to make artisanal goat cheese. So I really started thinking, like, how can you not see that the speciesism involved in exploiting animals and exploiting black and brown men at higher rates to put them in jail, prison, to be part of those workers of an agricultural labor force. Like, and they're getting 60 cents a day if they're lucky, or is it 60 cents an hour, or something very close to slavery. So in this conference, Lisbeth Ross, she's the founder of the Coalition of Anti-Racist Vegans of Color, and NNWN, who's part of the Restaurant Workers Alliance in New York, they talked about, you know, these intersections that she had shown these pictures of inmates milking cows in jail. And, you know, just thinking about the racism and the speciesism happening together, and that the cows and these black and brown men both don't have a choice in the system. So that's like some of the things we talked about during this conference to make it more clear that, you know, Black Lives Matter, and it's totally part of the ahimsa vegan praxis. And that if you kind of ignore that or dismiss it, you're not going to solve the species problem and the racist problem when you don't understand how they work together. Also interesting during the conference was that we had a non-black identified ally, Dr. Harlan Weaver, and he brought an anti-racist vegan animal focus to his work on pit bulls. And Dr. Weaver, he recognized how cisgender, transgender, racial, and able-bodied identities influence mainstream America's relationships to pit bull. And he looked at the Michael Vick case from a few years ago, and the responses to largely white vegans who did not understand that they were having more of a racialized response to his actions in comparison to maybe white male chefs who boil lobsters alive. There isn't that uproar. So there was more or less, were they upset about the way animals were treated, or was it basically a direct attack against cultures of blackness and inner city and hip-hop? Because there was a lot of people saying things like, this is what happens when you have a rap culture, a hip-hop culture, inner city blacks, this is what they do, this is how they treat animals. So what was really going on there? And he had this magnificent talk talking about his work with pit bulls, but also how he is read as a white trans man, and how when he's walking with the pit bull, what that pit bull does in terms of how people read him, his gender, and his race, and what is acceptable because he has the pit bull and his race and his gender, versus when it's acceptable or when it's not acceptable when black and brown people have pit bulls. So it was just I thought it was a very important a talk that he gave, and he's working, I think, on a book for this. But it was just a way to really think about not just in terms of race, but also gender and beyond cisgender, but, you know, what it means to be a gender nonconforming person, a white person who has this pit bull, versus what was happening with Michael Vick. So we talked about that, and that you, like, once again, race is not in a vacuum, gender is not in a vacuum, non-human animal and human relationships are not in a vacuum, but when you listen to Dr. Weaver's talk, you can see it all coming together, that you can't separate it. And then looking at, once again, what was on trial, was Michael Vick's supposed collusion with treating pit bulls in a very immoral way, was that on trial, or was black culture and kind of re-demonizing black culture. Is that what was going on when a lot of the white vegans were very upset about what was happening? So it's kind of hard to separate that. And he brought up that a lot of the mainstream white vegan world may not even realize consciously that that's what they're doing. So that was a really great talk and very necessary. I was interested in is this notion of a lot of the black liberation movement for a long time has been referring to cops as pigs, pigs as cops. So we looked at the work of Emory Douglas. This is one of his works, and he's one of the members of the Black Panther Party that started out in Oakland, California. And he has done amazing work in terms of understanding how to liberate black people. He himself is a vegan, actually. And he has a book that all these collected works that are similar to this, and the representations of pigs as cops as pigs, I've never liked it, but I also needed to understand deeply why it's important, to this important image. And he's the one who's basically coined pigs as cops as pigs. That's his work. So I invited Kevin Tillman of the vegan hip-hop movement for he and I to have a dialogue about, you know, this. Is there a way we can critique this without dismissing all the work that he and Black Liberationists of Black Panther Party have done? Is there a way we can critique it, but also build on it and fill those gaps, you know, what we perceive as like kind of a specious vegan rhetoric that Emory Douglas seems to have because he's vegan. And we're just curious on, you know, what can his work look like when we stop particularly referring to, you know, pigs in this manner? Is there a way for us to kind of move beyond that, but also understand why collectively black people have this, you know, very intense relationship, negative relationship with the police state?
Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM is political.
Co-op Radio is poetry.
Co-op Radio is tango.
Co-op Radio is gay.
Ecology.
Comedy.
Feminism.
Philosophy.
Yoga.
Reggae.
Bicycles.
Trade unions.
Gospel.
Live.
Local.
Asian.
African.
Vancouver Co-op Radio is community.
Your community.
Vancouver Co-op Radio.
CFRO.
100.5 FM.
All different.
All the time.
My name is Eric McDavid from the Central Valley of California. Just got out of prison 6 months ago after doing a 9-year bid for conspiracy to utilize explosives against government property and interstate commerce. Here for the conference to speak and share in ideas and conversation and like provide another perspective for folks within the AR community and to like create a deeper connection between AR community as well as like all the other movements and communities that create the space of where all of us are kind of moving towards, even though we may be in different communities. I think that's like the most important part for me, like just like that connectability and like gaining like a tangible connection to people and having that as like a foundation to move forward from.
I'm here basically to get more information. I'm doing a grad school program in Michigan, and eventually I'd like to teach, but I'm just here kind of getting more information on resistance ecology. And I do volunteer work at Farm Sanctuary. It's a sanctuary in Orland, California. And yeah, I'm just here to kind of network and check out what's happening up in the Northwest.
And now I want to share a little clip from Jake Conroy. He's a longtime animal rights activist who was sentenced to 4 years in prison for his involvement in one of the most successful animal rights campaigns in history, Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty. He spoke at Resistance Ecology this year. The talk was called Purity Politics, How Animal Liberation is Keeping Us from Animal Liberation. And he talked about how How when he first went vegan, you know, 20 years ago, someone gave him this 92-page booklet of animal ingredients and byproducts, and they were like, and don't mess it up. And he talked about how kind of unrealistic that is and how that really makes us kind of just really have a myopic focus on these little details, and is that really helping our movement? And yeah, it was a really interesting talk, and here's how he concluded it.
So we as an animal rights movement have so much talent and potential to bring about giant social change. And I would argue we already have shifted things in really massive ways. But I think we have so much more potential if we start to position ourselves as part of a bigger liberation struggle, rather than place ourselves as the moral superior off on the fringe. And I find our movement sounding more and more like the religious right all the time. We claim we are the voice for the voiceless. We speak for those who can't speak for themselves. And does that sound familiar? Is that a movement that we want to portray? Right? It says that we know what's best for everyone, that it is our way or the highway, that we are morally superior to the rest of you. So a few days ago, a 20-year-old white, upper-class, cis man, who is a leader of one of the bigger grassroots animal rights groups in the U.S., wrote, "To be clear, I believe nothing short of a vegan diet is morally permissible." Think about how that sounds. How are we going to be taken seriously as a liberation movement if we have 20-year-old upper-class white men telling people of color, telling working-class and lower-class people, indigenous people, queer and trans people, that they are morally inferior because of what they are currently eating? The same food that that 20-year-old was probably eating just a couple years earlier. The animal rights movement has so much to offer, right? It fights for compassion in massive ways. It has resources and unbelievable talent, dedication, and passion. It has interesting strategies, has amazing tactics, but we can also be so much more if we share with and support those in other liberation struggles. If we fight side by side with them rather than trying to lift them up to our level. If we recognize our quest for purity as what is really holding us back. If we recognize that liberation means so much more to so many people beyond just, quote, animal liberation. We all want to be free, right? We all want to be free. And the sooner we can start acting and organizing like it, I think it can also be a reality.
All right, and I'm going to talk about a really inspiring group called Palestinian Animal League. And most of you probably haven't heard of this group, and so I'm going to talk a bit about what it's doing. The presentation given at Resistance Ecology showed how the Palestinian Animal League, or PAL, is just an example of amazing animal activism in occupied territory, a region where 76% of water is privatized by Israel and communities are not able to self-govern, in an area where 125 illegal settlements are fulfilling colonial aims to exploit the ecology of Palestine and its laborers. In this environment, there's an animal rights group. That's just amazing. And within this mess of oppression and imperialism are people who are protecting animals even though their own livelihoods are under constant threat and violence is the norm. And when we notice Israel as appearing as a beacon for animal rights in the media, we have to remember that they are participating in a system which inflicts violence to human animals constantly. And Bina Ahmad from the presentation at Resistance Ecology said that an Israeli soldier stomping on a Palestinian child with vegan boots is not animal liberation. And I might just be so bold and agree with that.
This gives us a glimpse into the brutality of the Israeli occupation and things that you don't hear. And we hear a lot about, obviously, the human suffering, but just the other impacts, the ecological impacts and impacts on animals that we don't either cover or we're just unaware of. I hope it challenges us in the U.S. to step up our activism even more, because to think of all the work that Palestinian Animal League is doing under occupation, mm-hmm. when the human beings are incredibly brutalized and limited in mobility and job access and food and security, and to still also be trying to move forward with animal rights work, I think is incredibly powerful. So I really hope that this challenges each and every one of us when we feel depressed, which is very easy to do, or discouraged, that We are in a very privileged nation. We're a predominantly white movement. We have a lot of privilege, and I think we can step up our game.
Great. Why don't we hear something from Mai Farsak, who is the representative of Palestinian Animal League.
So there is a form of biological warfare by Israelis dumping wild boars and former military dogs and other animals into the Palestinian territory. This started around the second Intifada. This was the early 2000s when there was lots of Palestinian freedom fighters in hiding. They would hide in the mountainside if they were afraid to go back home and being taken into military custody. So they would put these animals in this place to kind of like create a fear factor or like even like draw out these people in hiding. They also secure the military base's perimeter or their various settlements' perimeters. So because their perimeter is fenced off and these animals can't infiltrate it, but it's really causing an ecological destruction to lots of the Palestinian farming areas. It's the boars are at the top of the hierarchy of the animal food chain because they are not indigenous to this habitat. So it's causing a lot of animal and human suffering, their presence. And it's an issue that we're trying to tackle as PAL to find the most appropriate way of dealing with this issue. So Israel has complete impunity in these areas and is there's lots of environmental discrimination taking place. So we're, as PAL, we're trying to challenge certain violations, like the boar incidents, for example, through test case, through legal court, and try to use their own arguments. There's recent efforts by Israel to exert jurisdictional dominance over the West Bank by applying their laws in our area. There's a recent military order. It became effect in June, early June, that Israeli laws can now be applied in the West Bank. So now we're trying to, okay, Israeli laws can be applied in the West Bank, well, let's tackle the wild boar issue, or let's tackle the settlement industrial enterprises that are in our lands. So we're trying to maybe utilize these clear steps to exert, you know, to annex and to dominate these territories, maybe for our benefit, legally speaking, in challenging these practices.
So that was a bit from the Palestinian Animal League. Yeah. Wow, very powerful talk. And again, that's the whole talk is posted on Resistance Ecology. So they're talking about, you know, colonial struggle. And of course, that's something on this land that is very real for us on colonized Turtle Island. One talk that really kind of brought together a solidarity with indigenous movements and animal liberationists was the local group known as Wildlife Defense League. We've interviewed them on the show before, but I want to highlight them here.
What's so inspiring about Wildlife Defense League is really its commitment to already supporting resistance, which is in place by indigenous communities. So they're not going into places and saying, look, like, let's do it our way, because of course that has a colonial flavor to it. And so there's a real sense of solidarity to these communities.
So yeah. They give a presentation that basically covered the campaigns to stop the exploitation of wildlife. And they also focus on their work with the Klobona Keepers, which is an indigenous nation up north in the Chukotin territory. And they basically, they're defending an area known as the Sacred Headwaters. So Wildlife Defense League was there last year, and that was their first official campaign where they were working with the Klobona Keepers to stop trophy hunting and defend the wildlife in that area, and basically blockading and preventing trophy hunters from entering the indigenous territory there.
And another thing which they do is really redefine what veganism means. So for Wildlife Defense League, veganism goes beyond the diet and becomes an anti-colonial practice which amplifies the oppressed voices of indigenous communities. And it is a way of building coalitions and fighting against a common imperialist enemy.
Interesting, yeah. And And there was other people from what's known as British Columbia down at the conference. Kanahus Freedom was there. She is a dedicated warrior, resistor, and she's part of the Sequapmuc Women's Warrior Society, based around what is known as Kamloops, as far as I understand. And she did a couple talks at the conference, and this one here I'm going to share is her story of how the Mount Pawley disaster is affecting her people. And if you don't know, she'll tell you a bit about what that is now.
Imperial Metals, they have different mining operations throughout so-called British Columbia, but they had one of the worst environmental tailings disasters. It's on August 4th. It's been 8 months now, or is that going on, almost going on 9 months since this disaster happened. It dumped a whole tailings impoundment area, a whole tailings pond into fresh, clean, glacier-fed water and salmon spawning grounds. Like 3 miles by 3 miles, three telephone poles high, filled with mercury and arsenic and processing chemicals, lead, zinc, copper, selenium, like so much things that will impact the our clean environment and territory. It also, on top of that, and what we found out, which was really disgusting, was that they were bringing in human solid waste from the Greater Vancouver area and also dumping that into there. And they were also dumping the medical waste from Vancouver into there. And they were also putting the operations, the 350 people that work there a day, their sewage, raw sewage, into the tailings pond for the last 7 years. So that's all what was included in that, and who knows what other types of chemicals, all dumped into the lake while their salmon was coming through. One of the second largest sockeye salmon spawning grounds in the world. And this is what they want to have be a precedent, that they're able just to come in, cover it up, start business as usual, get permits from the province on unceded lands, and continue to bring mining into our homelands. And it's destroying our people. It's killing our people. Like, if we don't stop this from happening, there's 90 plus more tailings ponds in British Columbia right now. They are trying to fast-track mining and get into the last of our remaining untouched areas of our territories. Our people have such a deep embedded connection to our territory. When we say the blood and bones of our ancestors, that's what we're walking on every day. You connect with all those thousands and tens of thousands of years ago, the same blood that walked in the same area. It's like such a deep connection. Our people cannot exist without land. The salmon is so important to who we are as Indigenous people. We all depend on that salmon. If we don't have that salmon, we don't have nothing. It's what kept our people alive during all the hardship that our people faced. And since, you know, colonial contact, it was the salmon. The salmon brought us through all the hard winters, everything. And what the scientists are saying is that it's going to take years, even 10, 20, 50 years to see the accumulated impacts that all those toxins are going to have on our salmon, because it's bioaccumulates and it gets stronger up the food chain. If you're living here and you're drinking our water and you're living on our territory and you're breathing our good air, then help us fight for it. If I go somewhere or to a tribe in tribal territory in Africa somewhere, I would have an obligation. Like, I would feel in my heart that I cannot turn my back, that they're my people too. And I think that when we talk about defense of Indigenous territories, that it's not just the Indigenous people's responsibility. It's everybody that's occupying and breathing that good air and drinking that good water. You know, it's the responsibility of everybody, because they're doing it for everybody's children. Because as Native people, we always think about, we say 7 generations ahead. What do we see in 7 generations ahead? we could just let the nation state control what's going to happen in seven generations, or we could say, create a vision of what you want to see, and 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 be able to create it, because we have the power to do that as people. And we are the masses. We're not a minority. Like, when you, it's just people don't know how to be involved, and we have to be able to create spaces like this and be able to create think tanks, just like the government of America and the government of Canada. They have their major think tanks. They have their military think tanks. They have their economic think tanks. They have all these think tanks in these high places that are trying to create the way that they want us to live, or the way that they want to continue to make money off of Indigenous territories and live their fancy lifestyles. But we have the power to also create a vision of what we want to see and be able to start saying, okay, if that's what we want to see in seven generations, what do we want to see in 100 years? What do we want to see in 50 years? And what do we, so what do we need to do within these next 20, 10, 5 years, 1 year? Goals, rather than just, because we have the capabilities to be able to organize them.
That was Kanahus Freedom talking at the 3rd Animal Resistance Ecology Conference. A reminder that Imperial Metals, they're based in so-called Vancouver on Hornby Street. And there's been a lot of actions and marches and education events about like what's happening. And they're connecting, you know, what happened at Mount Polley with what happens in South America and, you know, mining operations all over the world. It's definitely environmental racism. You know, it's 8 months later and people are thinking that's past and it's all been cleaned up now. But people like Kanahus are trying really hard to show people that it's not cleaned up. It's being covered up and it's a giant disaster. And I think personally, for me, that's one of the things in the last year, like, that has touched my heart the deepest. Amanda Lickers was also at the conference. I wanted to share some of her spoken word. Amanda Lickers is an anti-pipelines organizer from the Six Nations Haudenosaunee area in what she calls KK Canada. And she did some really powerful spoken word there, and she talked about her work with Reclaim Turtle Island. They're a budding platform for Indigenous-run grassroots media projects, and it's a form of anti-colonial cultural production, and it's primarily focused on producing media for and by Indigenous folks, helping to strive for total liberation.
Indian number 251-00975, my identification is signed thanks to a Band Council declaration of the validity of my blood relations, now to be defined through a male line. Being interracially mixed is an intimate conflict. Am I a successful colonial project? Displaced histories erase the internalization of imperial fates twisted by systems that seek to construct my race. By mapping my lineal ties with the state that took so many lives can now give me Indian status certified by a nation built on the invasion and devastation of whole generations, further cultivating colonization with this manufactured app, original identity, which has nothing to do with indigeneity. It's a compilation of whitewashed interpretations erecting a pan-Indian fixation. Because the colonial interest rate doubles, triples in hate as the First Nations threat continues to connect and protect ourselves, refusing to be thrown in cells, criminalized in the face of cultural genocide. And it's all intentional. It was no accident when Europeans fled off of their boats, and today the civilization gloats of its glory. Internalized, externalized white supremacy, devouring natural resources, developing industry, eating up the wealth of the earth, coughing up black tar dirt, all in the name of economy. But I won't settle for the lies that have been fed to me. We need to look to the trees and dream of resistance, resilient, a social arrangement not reliant on the exploitation and domination of any of Mother's creations. So, GMO genocide, three sisters burned alive, pollen contamination, and alien invasion of genetically modified corn and beans, patented by Monsanto's corporate greed, launching a full attack on our sovereignty. The same criminals privatizing seed, proliferated poison spraying fields of human beings, modifying chromosomes, spreading disease. Ancient Orange, chemical war, and the intertwined horror of the food industry, and the genocidal history of Monsanto's need to criminalize the natural calling medicines, weeds, hiring private mercenaries, manufacturing diabetes, subsidizing monoculture monopoly. Agribusiness lies, CEOs hide, empires built to copyright all life. Now taking DNA from corn and soybeans, but the assault doesn't stop. At the cow feed, these fuckers are now engineering salmon species, desecrating sanctity, spreading atrocity across the sea. So many territories, harvesting death culture profiteers hoard, these militarized merchants turn food to war, taking the life sustainers, gifts from creation, manipulating molecules, absolutely no humility, transforming the natural into industry. How can we resist this assimilation, continued invasion, seeking a siege, all from stream to siege, all from streams to seed. Grow food for our nations. Remember planting a ceremony.
Amanda Lickers is an anti-pipelines organizer from the Six Nations Haudenosaunee area in what she calls KK Canada. Any final words or things that that we didn't touch on today? We have a few more minutes.
I just wanted to quickly say that Resistance Ecology is kind of fairly quickly uploading all of the videos from their conferences onto, I think, Facebook. And there's a Vimeo channel called Burning Hearts Media. And basically, Burning Hearts has basically volunteered to record and edit all the talks and presentations at Resistance Ecology. So if you miss the conference, you can always watch most of the talks online. And another thing I forgot to mention earlier was that if you're interested in checking out Breeze Harper's Sista Vegan conference, it's also available online. And there's for $25, you'll be able to get all the slides and videos and whatnot.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. And I think it's really powerful too. Just that, you know, animal liberationists, animal advocates, animal activists can talk about what it looks like to show solidarity and to act, you know, as allies or as accomplices in dismantling the system, even if we don't agree on everything. Jake Conroy was saying in his talk, what's the first things we sometimes ask other activists? Are you vegan? And he was trying to point out, is that really, you know, is that really mm-hmm. the biggest issue? Or does it matter, that in a broader sense, we're mm-hmm. connected?
Well, also, when we're talking about solidarity or allyship, you know, is asking other activists, are you vegan? Is that really showing solidarity? You know, going to their events and handing out vegan leaflets, is that really showing solidarity? No, you're using it as a platform to spring your movement. And so to put our agenda aside for a while and show real concern for their oppression, that's showing solidarity, not pushing our views.
For people who are, you know, poorer people and people who are really struggling for many different ways, Indigenous people, all that, it's just not a question that should ever come up. Yeah. And that was really driven home by many of the speakers.
Yeah.
Particularly, I was thinking of Lauren Ornelas and who does the Food Empowerment Project, helping migrant workers, you know, the people who pick our vegetables and fruits, how they're struggling and how we need to focus on that and humble ourselves. I have a lot of privilege. I'm, you know, white, cisgendered, able-bodied settler on this land. And, you know, I just want to learn about other people's struggles. And who was someone else who talked about that was Dylan Powell, who does a lot of solidarity organizing over in so-called Ontario. And he works very hard on marineland animal defense. So that was another really powerful talk. So let's see. Well, that's our show today. I hope you enjoyed it. definitely stay in touch with us via social media. We love to hear from you. So if you have feedback about our show or something you want to hear more of on the show or any kind of feedback, we love to hear that you're listening because, you know, radio is kind of lonely. Our email address is radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We are going to leave you with another song by DJ Kavum. That's a friend of Breeze Harper, and he talks a lot about how building healthy bodies is part of the resistance. So he's a really amazing, like, health advocate and, you know, Black justice activist. So here's the song Wheatgrass by DJ Kavum. Check out our show next week. We have a really excellent show planned for you. And have an amazing weekend. Remember to be kind to all beings, all animals. I got a job with some teens, teaching hip-hop history and how to grow greens. Hard skills, big wheels, and it's the real deal. Green jobs, green thumbs up in the green field. And ain't nobody be ditching my class. I got the lifelong lessons, don't let your life pass. I got some knowledge on my mind. Cause in divine, I say divine in the past time, spit rhyme. So a sustainable kid, don't assume. Just break it down, see me in the teachers now. What's sustainable kid, don't assume. Just break it down, see me in the teachers now. What you learn, how to write rhymes, how to grow food. What you learn, how to meditate, how to fight for tools. So what you learn, how to unite, how to rap through. So what you learn, how to give back, how to pay dues. I watch my youth shine and elevate in 09. Cause when the cycle born, see, you know, I water.